Welcome to the City Club of Eugene, June 21st, 2019 program, Climate Change and Wildfire Risk in Lane County. My name is Eric Richardson. I'm the president-elect of the City Club. Support comes from the University of Oregon. Since 1876, the University of Oregon has helped Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information at uoregon.edu. At Peace Health, their mission is shaped by their shared purpose since they were founded more than 125 years ago. They exist to promote personal community wellness, to relieve pain and suffering, to treat each person in a loving and caring way. For more information, visit peacehealth.org. And our Sapphire sponsor, AARP Oregon. AARP Oregon celebrates creating livable communities for all ages. Learn more at aarp.org. So now on to the program. Today's program coordinator, Randy Prince, will please join us at the podium to introduce today's topic and speakers.
Thanks, Eric, and welcome to our program on climate change and the wildfire risk for Lane County. You know, it's been a rough couple of years for California and its relationship with wildfires. Oregon hasn't had it so easy either. But for California, the list of fires, the numbers of homes burned in minutes or hours, the costs, thousands of acres torched, the names of the people killed, it's long. It could take our whole hour to recount. We see the enormity of the problem. It's in the news, and then for many, we put away the images and reports, forget it perhaps. It's the new normal, or maybe it's the new abnormal, as California's governor called it. Oregon seems lucky by comparison, but are we? Climate change drives much of this phenomena, as well as growth and population. Do we face a future like our neighbor to the south? Could things get worse here? We already had a couple of the worst years on record. Certainly the costs of fighting these fires set records in our state in the last 2 years. The problem that worries the most people, what's in the forefront, is wildfire in the wildland-urban interface. And that includes hilly cities that are covered by trees, like about half of Eugene. So what are we doing to prepare, and what are homeowners doing? What are local fire departments doing? We are helping our rural residents. It's not true everywhere. In Australia, you're on your own if you live out in the country. They just can't cover all that. And we have to appreciate what we can do to live with fire. We have to understand what we can't do like they do there in Australia. I noticed this cover of a magazine, a New York magazine last month, Living with Fire is the topic. There's a young man there. He's skateboarding. He's texting or reading his smartphone, and in the background is the disastrous Woolly Fire. He's right on PCH1, probably, you know. And it's sort of recognizing the reality of it. As environmental historian, famous writer Mike Davis said, "No one will ever be honest about this, but firefighters have never stopped a wildfire powered by Santa Ana winds. All you can do is hope that the wind will change." We don't have Santa Ana winds here, but we do have conditions, and you know about them, that make it impossible to put out fires. But we're going to focus a bit more on the positive today, but also what we can expect. And our first speaker will be Tim Inglesby, who has a PhD in environmental sociology from the University of Oregon. He is the co-founder and executive director of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology, FUSE. It's become a nationally known organization, and he's a faculty research associate at the University of Oregon. He will be followed by Stephen Wallace, who is fire chief of the Mohawk Valley Rural Fire Department in Marcola, Oregon. He's been in the fire service since 2000. He's also served as a trainer and supervisor for EMTs and emergency medical services, and his department works with residents to create safer spaces around rural homes. Following that, we'll have a first question from Thomas Price. I'll tell you more about him. But at this time, Tim, you're on.
I find it safest for me to have hands-off technology, or else. Thank you to the City Club for inviting me to speak to you here in the room and to the larger community via KLCC Radio. I'm here to talk about two of the burning issues of our time, climate change and wildfire. And I'm a certified fire ecologist. I've lived in Eugene and rural Lane County for almost 40 years now. I've been doing fire ecology education and policy advocacy for most of that time. And years ago, many of my colleagues in the fire management community used to wonder and joke with me, Tim, why are you living in Eugene on the wet side of the Cascades, where they used to believe wildfires were fairly rare and utterly remote events? But now they're not wondering, and nobody is joking anymore. Since the recent fire catastrophes in Northern California, where thousands of homes were destroyed, dozens of lives were lost in places like Santa Rosa and Redding and Paradise and many other unnamed rural communities, there's been a dramatic shift in public awareness about wildfires and concerns about climate change. Really, wildfire has suddenly become the specter of climate change, not just here in the West, but nationwide. And much of the metaphors, analogies, horror stories of climate change really do focus on wildfire. Unlike other symptoms of climate change, like melting ice caps or rising seas, that are dangers of climate change, but they still seem to many people far away in time or space, whereas wildfire could ignite and spread into anybody's backyard anytime. So folks in our community are concerned. Could a wildfire trigger an urban firestorm here? And since the late 1980s, climate change has been affecting wildfires, increasing wildfire activity. Fires start easier, they spread faster, grow larger, burn longer, and emit more smoke than happened in that post-World War II period from the 1950s to the 1980s, the period where Western housing development expanded into many fire-prone areas. People had no idea that their sprawling suburbs were located in naturally fire-prone environments. And when a wildfire did ignite, they were usually quickly contained and controlled by firefighters. During that post-World War II period, the 30 years from the 50s to the 80s, we had natural climate variability that brought us cooler and moister conditions across much of the West. And this enabled firefighters to successfully put out most fires, keep them small in size, short in duration. And this gave all of us, firefighters included, the illusion that it was our firefighting capacity and ability, not the weather or climate conditions, that allowed us to control wildfires. Well, that cool, moist period following World War II was also the heyday of old-growth clear-cutting and road building in the national forests. And in hindsight, some people believe that this logging was an asset to that firefighting success of the past. They believe that if we ramp up logging, we'll tamp down fires. Get the cut out to put the fire out. It's that simple. But now that the climate is becoming ever hotter and drier, fire scientists have realized, and fire managers are reckoning with, the colossal error of both aggressive wildland firefighting and industrial logging. The fires of the past that would have, should have, burned that dead, downed needles and limbs, those shrubs and saplings that cover the forest floor, those were put out. The fires that indigenous peoples would have and could have used to maintain healthy habitats for fire-dependent species, those fires were not put in. So decades of extinguishing and excluding fire while converting naturally fire-resilient old-growth forest into highly flammable tree farms. These are now combining with climate change to fuel unstoppable wildfires. They spread from wildlands to communities, where they transition from wildfires into urban conflagrations. And we're still kind of stuck applying 20th century fire suppression policies, practices, to a 21st century climate. And meanwhile, fire colleges are really questioning, what was the meaning of success of that past fire suppression? So some people have coined the current climate-driven wildfires as the new abnormal, Governor Brown and others. But in fact, it was that three-decade period following World War II that was highly abnormal, the historical anomaly. Up through the 1940s, on average, 20 to 30 million acres burned in the U.S. every year, and there was no national crisis. The wildfires today are barely making a dent in that deficit of burning that would have, could have, should have recycled some of that material into healthy soil. Fires that many forests, shrubland, grassland ecosystems absolutely need to maintain their health and ecological integrity. Large-scale, long-duration wildland fires are natural, normal, inevitable, vital for native biodiversity and ecological integrity. We cannot prevent or suppress all wildfires, nor can we fully stop climate change. And climate change is creating these conditions that are fueling these urban conflagrations. But the fossil fuel pollution that is altering the chemistry of the planet's atmosphere and oceans, massive alterations of the landscape through industrial logging, the spread of flammable homes into fire-prone areas, these are not normal, natural, or inevitable. These can be stopped. These can be controlled. So where do we go from here? What can be done? First, we got to keep our focus on the main driver of climate change, and that is burning fossil fuels, not burning forests. Wildfires are a symptom, not the source of climate change. And I understand why fire is feared as a kind of real imminent danger that, you know, could threaten any of us tomorrow. While the dangers of climate change still seem a little bit far off and distant, the smoke plume on the horizon from a wildfire, that's fully visible. You can see it. You can smell it. The smoke from fossil fuel burning is largely invisible and odorless, and we just don't think about it in the same way. But we need to keep focused on the real source of the climate and wildfire crisis, not its symptoms. Second, retrograde proposals to ramp up logging as a means of preventing wildfires or storing carbon in wood products, these will be a disastrous response. It will make climate change even more rapid and its impacts much worse, especially with its impacts on fire behavior, fire effects. Again, we need to keep focused on fossil fuel pollution and not be deceived into supporting these grandiose geoengineering schemes to make a fireproof forest. Do more logging for firefighting projects. These will degrade forests. Meanwhile, we keep mining, drilling, spilling, fracking, and burning fossil fuels. We can't continue to do that. We live in a big tree bioregion, and the immense carbon stocks in our forests, especially the Western Cascades, these are a global resource that are part of the solution to climate restabilization. The immense carbon that they sequester and store, along with all the other values of clean air and clean water, biodiversity, these are, I would argue, values that far surpass their values as wood products. We have the potential for a bright future in Lane County as a leader in ecological forestry, ecological fire management, managing forests in ways that sequester and store carbon long-term while being resilient to fires in the short term. And scientists and their students in Oregon's universities are right now, working on discovering that sweet spot of a carbon-rich, fire-resilient forest and a truly ecologically sustainable forestry. Third, we need to restore our species' long-standing and unique relationship with fire in the land. Counterintuitively, more fire, not less, is the key to stabilizing, to creating stable forest ecosystems and storing the most carbon over the long term. Again, prescribed fires, managing wildfires will help recycle that surface fuel material into fertile soil while protecting the big trees and organic soils, that those are the long-term stores of carbon. That's where most of it exists, and that's where it should be maintained. And we're going to need to do this in perpetuity. Last but most importantly, we need to make a distinction between those wildfires that burn in remote wildland areas and wildfires that burn into urban areas. We need more of the former, none of the latter. The good news is that we have the knowledge, we have the skills, tools, technology to make homes fire resistant, and professionals like my co-panelists here to help us prepare for fire. Relatively low cost, simple retrofits like non-flammable roofs, screening your roof vents, these can increase the probability of your home surviving a wildfire over 90%. Spending billions of tax dollars to amp up firefighting or ramp up logging, there's no way that they can provide that kind of return on taxpayer investment with that kind of success. So we should concentrate our firefighting efforts on where it really matters, near our homes and communities. These cannot burn. While ecologically manning fires in remote, uninhabited wildlands, that must burn. So millions of homes were built in locations that, with designs and materials that make them more prone to burning than the surrounding vegetation. And it's really true when you see images of paradise. You see charred ruins of homes and green trees standing overhead. The homes are more flammable than the forest they're a part of. Fire is going to be part of our future as it has been part of our past. For a long, long time. We need to keep fires out of our communities while keeping fire in our ecosystems. And we have the knowledge, skills, tools, technology to do that if we have the collective wisdom and will to do so. And we can draw inspiration. This is not just my pyrotopian dream of the future. This is part of our past. We inhabit the ancestral homelands of the Kalapuya Indians who used fire frequently, intentionally, wisely, and they did it in ways that protected their villages and enhanced the natural bounty of nature. Fire was part of their harvesting and hunting practices. It sustained their civilization for 10,000 years. Over that span of time, natural climate variability had hot, dry periods, prolonged droughts, lightning storms, and they survived with fire. Using fire, not fearing it, not fighting it. And we need to relearn some of that ancient wisdom fused with our modern ecological science in ways that we really do have the ability to live with and work with wildland fire. But the real fight is to stop fossil fuel pollution, stop industrial logging. That's a fight that we can and must win. So I leave you with just one last message. The sooner we prepare our homes and communities for fire, the sooner we can restore and sustain our forest ecosystems with fire. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Good afternoon. My name is Chief Stephen Walls. I'm with the Mohawk Valley Fire District. First of all, I'd like to thank the City Club for having me here today to talk about this very important issue. As you've heard and as you've seen in the news, wildfires are becoming kind of more common. They're coming closer to home, and we're starting to see them more publicized than we have in the past. I've been doing this about 19 years. the last 2 years is the first time that I know of in my career that Oregon has had to send resources to California to assist with wildfires. So obviously something has changed. When I started as a volunteer firefighter, we were maybe called up once a year to go on a conflagration fire throughout the state. If you got to go that year, it was a special year because something different happened. Last year, our department did 9 deployments within the state of Oregon and 1 deployment to Northern California. That is definitely not normal for our district to be doing. And it doesn't just affect our area. We have a massive wildfire somewhere else in the state. It affects the whole state to some degree. When we had the fires in California, Lane County sent 2 task forces to Northern California. That was 10 pieces of firefighting apparatus that had to leave from Lane County to go assist another community. And we do that because we know that someday our community will need to be assisted. And we hope that those resources come and help us. Because what we've learned over the years, and as you've heard today, we're not going to stop the major wind-driven fires. We're not going to stop some of these fires that are in these big fuels that are moving. There's nothing that we can do to stop them. So how do we protect the homes and how do we save the homes? Right? If we had that incident here in the South Hills or in my district out in Marcola, I know my fire department, my 3 paid staff and my about 25 volunteers will not be enough to save the homes in our district. That's why we have these relationships with our neighboring districts. That's why we act as one big group. One thing that I've learned the last couple years is I attended a conference a couple months ago. We have this conference every year at the beginning of fire season, talks about what to expect. We do some training to get ready for fire season. And part of that conference, a meteorologist from the National Fire Agency comes out and talks to us and gives us a fire forecast for the year and what we should expect and talks about the differences. I agree that climate is a big part of what is happening. Now, I'm definitely not educated enough to get into exactly how the climate affects everything and what's affecting the climate, but I know that plays a fact. In Oregon, the last couple years, a majority of our deployments on the fire department have been in Western Oregon. When I first started, if we went out on a deployment, it was Eastern Oregon. You know you were going east every time. But in the last 2 years, Western Oregon has received less rain and is drier than Eastern Oregon. You can't really say that's normal. And that's a scary fact when you think about it. So wildfires are going to happen on the west side of the state. And they happened in the last couple years mostly on the west side of the state. If you look at the trends of wildfires over the years, most of your massive wildfires were Arizona, Southern California. If you look at the trends the last couple years, it's moving north. Western Washington is expected to have the worst fire season out of all of us this year. And that's probably someplace you would think would be the moistest, the wettest area, right? You wouldn't think of that being the most prone for wildfire seasons, but that's kind of the one area that they've flagged this year, that Western Washington and Northwest Oregon are going to be the really bad areas this year. And that's getting closer to home. So how do we protect these homes? We talked about there's not enough resources to protect every house. I have somewhere around 4,500 residents in my fire district. I can't protect 4,500 homes with 30 people. It's just not doable. So part of that, part of the surviving the wildfire is our responsibility as homeowners. I live in an urban interface area. I have trees around my house, fields around my house. And it is partially my responsibility to make sure that my house can survive a wildfire because I'm not going to get a fire engine to my house every time. It may not be safe to have that fire engine at my house. So how do we do that? We used to think, and it's a big misperception over the years, that the way your house burns down in a wildfire is you have this huge wall of flames that come sweeping through the trees and it hits your house and catches your house on fire. That's not true. Flames aren't getting to the house. What's getting to the house is the ember showers. If you guys ever have time to go online, look up some of the ember shower videos and demonstrations that they have. Okay, it's not the flames that are touching our homes. It's the waves of embers that are flying through the air that are getting to our homes. So how does the ember catch the house on fire? Well, it's easy. How many people have flower beds up against their homes? Pine needles from trees that have fallen? Dead leaves? Dead grass, right? That's the stuff that catches on fire easily. That's what ignites. The dead leaves in the flower bed next to the house, that ignites. and now you have direct flame contact on your house. If you have trees overhanging your home and you have dry pine needles in your gutters or in the corner of your roof or on your porch or under your porch, those are the places that these embers are getting and starting those fires. Right. Screens on your attics. We talked about screens a little bit before. Having the right size of screen on your attic vents. Looking into the rating for that screen. I wish I had the pictures with me, but there was a home that the guys found in California that you can see completely burned around it, but it was standing. It had nice green grass around it, very low vegetation, screens, everything like that. The neighbor's house was still standing, but it had fire and smoke damage in the attic because the screen was too big, and you can see where all the embers landed inside that attic. It's sheer amazing that it didn't catch that attic on fire and burn that house down as well. So we have to take some responsibility ourselves to protect our homes. There's a lot of information out there. I could stand here for hours and talk about ways to defend our homes. But keep it simple. Think about the little things that you can do. Don't have large trees overhanging your house that's dropping dead fuels. I know 5-6 years ago, you were told that the only way to protect your house from a wildfire is you pretty much had to clear cut every tree from 50 to 100 feet around your home. That's not true. You can have trees around your house. You just have to maintain those trees. You have to clean up after that vegetation, clean up the dry fuels. Don't let those fuels pile up in the corners of your house or in the gutters. Okay, don't let the vegetation get into the trees. That's another big thing that we find is these fire fronts come through and they're able to make their way right up into your trees next to your home because you have blackberries or other bushes that are grown up into the trees, or your trees are all the way down into the grass. So even though you may have a nice mowed yard, that fire is going to creep through, and as soon as it gets into those pine needles, because those limbs are laying on the ground, that whole tree is going to torch. Now you have a massive ember shower that is raining down on your home. So you don't have to cut everything down. We just have to maintain it. That's the key, maintaining the area around our homes and maintaining the environment around our homes. We're not going to stop wildfires. They're never going to go away, and we need fire. Right? Fire is part of our history. It's part of our future, and it's how we manage our ecosystems. It's how we manage our forests. We burn forests on purpose because that's how we manage those forests and keep them healthy. We're never going to get rid of fire, but there's a lot of things that we can do to help survive the fire. You know, we could stop building in interface areas. I don't see that ever happening, okay? We're getting bigger. If you look at the city of Eugene and Springfield, they're huge, right? Where else are they going to expand? I can tell you, my district's one place they're expanding. I probably see 5 to 6 homes a year going up in my fire district right now. It's been a change for us. I mean, we ran 250 calls 5 years ago in a year. This last year, we ran 500. Our call volume almost doubled, and it goes up every year. Okay, so fires are the new norm. Emergencies are the normal. Building in the interface area, I don't think you're going to see that stop either. But we can do it in a way that's smart and that's safe to do it. Right? We can make sure that we have access to our homes. That's another thing that we run into a lot of times is if we can't get to your home to help protect it, there's nothing we can do. I talk to people all the time when I go on calls or even a medical call, and I'm driving my Suburban that's issued to me up a driveway, and I'm scraping tree limbs on the windshield of my Suburban. It's like, do you think there's any way that that fire truck's going to get up here right now? Right? So things like that, people don't think about that. And think about that even with medical calls. I'll digress a little bit. You know, access to your home is not just important to save your house during a wildfire or other, it's all other emergencies. If I can't get my Suburban up a driveway, has anybody seen ambulances nowadays? They're not little tiny vans, right? They get bigger and bigger because we do more and more and we carry more and more equipment, so everything has to get bigger as we do this. So make sure those fit up your driveway. It may just be a medical emergency, but not having that clearing, not having that access, may inhibit that help from coming during that type of emergency. Defensible space, that's the big thing you can do. I know I've kind of hammered that already. But keep that space around your home. Keep everything trimmed. Keep your gutters clean. I know when we first started doing this years ago that we went out to protect homes and we'd try to fight the fire. And if we couldn't, we'd leave. Now we get there early and we're gardeners. That's really what we are when we get there, is I spend days and days in these neighborhoods that I know the fire's coming to, blowing off roofs and weed eating around the house and sweeping decks and doing all that work is saving more homes than we were when we were trying to sit there with water hoses and actually stop the fire and fight the fire when it got to the house. So these tactics do work. We're learning how different things work. I know the climate is changing and the fire conditions are changing. Fire does not burn the same way today as it did 10 years ago. I sent crews to California that came back, and it was a real eye-opener to them because they came back and they go, you know what? That seemed a lot like what our climate's changing to. That seems a lot like how our fires are starting to burn. They kind of noticed that it's similar. They went down there and they saw a lot of similarities where there used to not be these, because we used to have a lot wetter areas. We used to not have this kind of fire conditions that we have now, but we're starting to get the fire conditions that you see in Southern California. Thank you guys for your time.
Before we go to our five-minute break for City Club members and guests to formulate questions for our panelists, we have a first questioner, Thomas Price. He is a Eugene resident in the Churchill area. That's one of those forested neighborhoods. He is the district lead for the City of Eugene's CERT program, the volunteers in the Community Emergency Response Teams. And he has been a trainer in the fire field. He has served in California 14 years with CAL FIRE, and he served 6 years in Oregon in Lane County, Lane Fire District 1. Also been on the Sustainability Commission for 4 years. Thomas, you have a question for one or both of our panelists? Go ahead.
Thank you, Randy. So the first thing I have to do is I'm not speaking as any of the official titles that were just said. I'm posing a question on behalf of City Club. Randy and I have talked about this, and I've fashioned this question. I'm going to ask the question and then give you a little more background. So first of all, beyond those titles, I'm an environmental scientist and a climate scientist as well. With your understanding of field moisture and how it impacts fire behavior, could defensible space as a singular approach or a main focus possibly need to be looked at in the light of the California fires, wildfires, and the way they move through whole subdivisions and houses, and sometimes didn't even ignite the wild land fuel around it before the houses were already burning. The reason I'm posing this question is, as a climate scientist, we're looking at heat island effects and how we are possibly bringing those heat island effects into the forest with us as we build into the forest. And as you know about microbiomes and microclimates, that fuel moisture and even the air's heat and water moisture can help those embers travel. So maybe there's something that we might need to rethink. I was one of those firefighters down in California that used to go around and cite people for the not having the 100-foot space, and we've invited that up into Northern California now. Do we want to keep inviting it up into Oregon?
You know, as far as this defensible space, it goes back to, like I said, we don't need a clear cut. It's all about what you plant and how you maintain what you plant around your home. A lot of those fires, and I've seen those myself, where the yard may not be burned and the bushes may not be burned, but the home is. And a lot of that is, one, what the home is built from and not being maintained. Those ember showers come through, they weren't enough to light all those green leafy trees on fire, but they were enough to light that duff or that dead pile of pine needles on the porch on fire, or the lawn chairs that were sitting on the porch on fire. So I don't think we need to go to the clear cut and increase defensible space, but I do think we need to maintain what we do have and maintain around our homes.
And speaking about fire ecology, you're certainly correct that the real issue is what's called fuel aridity, the dryness of the fuels. And that's what's phenomenal about the conditions. Anything, everything, smallest twig, largest log, is so dry and so ignitable by the tiniest ember. This is part of the reason that fires are getting so big is not that these giant tsunamis of flame exploding on the landscape. They are flying through the air, hopscotching, spotting ahead. Crews can't get in front of it. They got to back way off it, back off and burn out. That's about the only thing they can safely do. So where you have closed canopy forests, you're retaining moisture at the ground surface. So these efforts, oh, we got to thin the forest because the trees might burn and ground fires might spread. You're priming the pump for fast moving wildfires because you're allowing sun and wind to get right there on the ground where fuels where a cigarette butt could light them. The tree crowns, it takes a lightning bolt, but all the material on the ground is a cigarette butt. So I think wherever we can, we need to retain canopies, retain moisture, and manage those surface fuel loads and manage for the microclimate conditions. I just have to say, I was concerned about climate change back in the 1980s with clear cutting, because that's what was happening. It was opening up the forests to all these edge effects of sun and wind, drying out our rainforest. Here we have a clear cut, and the adjacent stand of old growth was getting dry, all kinds of invasive weeds entering in. So you're right about that, and the chief is right about, you know, homes can be more flammable than surrounding vegetation. And I'll confess, I live in a home built in the 1940s. It's got original old growth cedar shake siding. I got a flower bed right under my window. I could do better. I could do better, that's for sure.
We will now go to our 5-minute break for you in the audience to prepare your questions for the panelists.
Good evening. You're listening to City Club of Eugene on KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. You can find all City Club of Eugene programs on our website, klcc.org.
Welcome back to the June 21st, 2019 program, Climate Change and Wildfire Risk in Lane County. But before we proceed, I'd like to recognize some more of our sponsors, our gold sponsors, Banner Bank, Dr. Sandy Ibarra, Heron Associates, Guido Turnside, and the Balthrop PC. And a special thanks to our in-kind sponsors, KRVM 91.9 Radio, Dotson's Photography, and PAC Info Simplified Computing LLC. So we'd like to return to our program by asking our questioners to go ahead and come up to the microphone and go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed with your question. Thank you.
Ruth Zamler. In 1948, we discovered what air pollution was at Caltech. And in the 1950s, Roger Revelle talked to us about climate change, and everybody laughed. But it's here. And I'm very concerned about what's happening to the forests. I understand that in Southern California, especially now, they're planting different kinds of trees to help cure the problem as far. We're not doing anything about climate change, it seems, but we could do something maybe at the moment about trees and planting. And I understand we're planting along the coast different trees, but there's something called Magnaflora tree. Do you know about that? New kind of tree that they're developing in Southern California that will stop the fires? Or do you know of any other trees that they're planting to?
I don't know of any other trees by name, but I have heard that they are trying different species of trees. I have heard that they're trying different types and species of trees that are less flammable to plant forests with those to help slow down fire risks and slow down the progression of fire. I don't know any exact names, but I have heard of that research happening.
I actually have seen some trees that won't burn. I believe that was in Frontierland at Disneyland. And that's about it. And, you know, there's a reason that fires and firs are so phonetically close. Wildfires and wildflowers, so phonetically close. And we have to stop thinking about fire as some alien enemy force that threatens forests. Realize that the forest evolved with fire. people evolved with fire and forests. And it really, you know, if you go back to the early 1900s, it was California timbermen that were the biggest advocates for using fire to thin out the, you know, to keep that duff and litter layer, you know, whittled down and thin out some of the abundant saplings that were kind of competing with the big trees for water and nutrients. We need to remember that. So I don't know about trees that don't burn other than frontier land.
Bob Cassidy, City Club member. Two quickies. Lightning rods. Nobody talks about those anymore, and that used to be a very popular thing, certainly on every barn or tall item. But the big concern I've had is that firefighters have told me that they have difficulty getting to the fires because of the condition of the road. Who's responsible for taking care of these roads that have been put in by the lumber companies?
Steve Wallace, Chief Mohawk Fire. The biggest responsibility falls on the landowner themselves. We have no enforcement of private property, really. So it's up to the landowners to maintain those roads to be usable. I completely understand what you're saying. I've been on fires where it's taken me hours to get to the fire because I need to find a road that's passable or it gets me close enough to the fire. So I understand that. And there's a lot of roads that once they don't use them anymore, they grow over and it makes it difficult to get to these locations. Unfortunately, we have no enforcement power on that. I would hope that the landowners, the timber's valuable to them, so I would think that they would want to maintain those access so we could get there and save as much timber as we could.
I'll speak about the conditions of roads in the national forest. And like Steve was mentioning, how ridiculous it was in the face of oncoming fire, firefighters are pruning shrubs, raking leaves, moving wood piles. Okay, that's something homeowners should be doing. We're not maintaining those old logging roads except when a fire is. And I've been talking to like private contract crews that are often assigned to do lots of roadside brush clearance and chipping, which should have been done long before, but now it's this emergency, you know, situation, and they're facing lots of hazards, engines and crews rolling up the roads while they're trying to. So under the cover of firefighting costs, we're smuggling in a lot of road maintenance that would have and should have been done well prior. So
John Dolo, City Club, and my question is, how's the rest of the world doing? I mean, I know we're having problems. How about Europe and Africa?
You know, on the wildfire side, you see it on the news everywhere. Australia is having massive wildfires. Canada is already having fairly massive wildfires. So it's not just an Oregon issue or Western United States issue. It is a global issue, and it's becoming more common everywhere, not just here.
My name is Bernie Bopp. I'm a City Club member. I'm asking this question for a City Club guest here today. How can we stop people from building in the fire-prone areas or make them 100% financially responsible for the costs of doing so?
I don't know if I'm the best person to answer that question. Obviously, building permits, building codes, all that stuff doesn't go through the fire districts. That's all a county-driven thing. But like I said, I think building in these areas is inevitable. But I do think that maybe stronger requirements on maintaining those areas or what you're using to build those homes in the first place would come into play here. Building those homes out of the right types of materials and having that requirement to maintain some of that property and that space would definitely help a lot with those situations, allow firefighters more time. They wouldn't be spending as much time on single places, and it would probably drive down the cost of fighting these fires a little bit because they wouldn't get as big or cost as much time to prep these homes.
I don't know if I agree that it's inevitable. You know, I think we should build a wall against suburban sprawl for the fire issue, but really, we've got millions of existing homes right now that are out there, particularly in rural areas, and not everyone who lives in rural America are rich. It's not a trophy secondary. There's a lot of poverty in rural America. There's a lot of elderly people living in rural America. And this is where a natural fit between strong young bodies and experts in the fire services and the fire sciences and whole communities can come together and relatively simple things to begin with to help, you know, make homes, existing homes, more fire resistant. It can be done, should be done, and with incentives or penalties or whatever. And it's not just a private property owner right, it is a community responsibility, and when we all kind of come together to see happen.
Tom Bowerman, City Club sponsor. I couldn't help but with having two experts up here to ask your opinion about a more global approach, which is public policy. Here we have in this very yesterday and today and the next several days, the legislature has been working for 10 years to establish a cap and trade policy, which has a lot of components about dealing with the very thing that on the ground and the local area. But one might say that there's a spectrum of if climate change becomes a problem, we can deal with it later, versus climate change is an existential threat that we need to deal with now in public policy. So here we have a small group of legislators walked out, preventing a quorum. You've read about it, you've heard about it. As experts on the ground, what do you think about that?
I don't know if I'm the best person to answer this question either. I have my own beliefs, they're my personal beliefs, and I think that there are things that we can do to better the environment and to better our circumstances. Do I believe that everything that has been put out there is the answer? Probably not. I think there needs to be a little bit more compromise and really think about what's going to be the best, not just for the climate or just for the people, but, you know, all of us as a group. You know, what's going to help the environment while not threatening people or livelihoods, things like that. I think that there's a fine line there, and I don't know the answer, and that's why I'm not a politician.
Speaking for myself, I think it's a shocking dereliction of duty that these legislators skipped out of town. I have mixed feelings about, you know, cap and trade. It still permits pollution. I think this mentality that the solution to pollution is dilution is a delusion. And we just got to cap and reverse it, okay? So maybe this is a halfway measure to get us started in that direction, but it's just shocking, you know? So as they say, you know, if the people lead, the leaders will follow. And if these legislators are denying, it's not even denial, it's just mass deception. We are fiddling while the planet burns. And it's time that all of us reassert our power to deal with the real crisis, the really burning issue of our time is climate change, absolutely. And I look forward to us coming together to do that. Thank you.
Hi, Rebecca Flynn, City Club member. So I have a question about federal policy, but don't worry, Chief, I'm not going to ask you to take a position. My understanding is that, you know, fires are getting more intense and worse because of climate change and moisture, but also just the fuel load. And my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that a lot of firefighting is controlled by federal policy, which is oriented towards putting the fire out. And so during fire season, we as, you know, community members are saying, oh, the fire's 90% contained. Oh no, and hey, now it's 30% contained and we're rooting for containment. But my understanding is that might not be the thing to do. And I'm just curious, in a perfect world, what would the policy be towards, you know, what is federal policy right now? Is it we must contain every fire? And what do you think would be more helpful?
You know, it really depends on the agency and the location of the fire. So if a fire starts on federal lands, the federal government has their own requirements and way of dealing with that. Where if the fire starts on state lands or private lands, then the priorities are different. Federal fires, a lot of times, they'll let them burn a little bit longer and they fight fire with more fire and things like that to try to contain it and control it, but still let it somewhat take its natural course. Where when you get fire on private lands or state protected lands like Weyerhaeuser lands and stuff like that, the main goal at that point is to put those fires out due to the lost revenue and things like that. that go along with those. It also depends on the location of the fire, too. When you have a fire burning in the middle of the city, the priority is going to be to put that fire out because life safety comes first, where some of these fires that are out in the middle of the wilderness, they'll let them burn and try different tactics instead of just trying to get them contained right away.
Yeah, you wouldn't know this, but we actually have the most progressive fire policy in federal government ever. And, you know, we have the ability to use all the tools, all the tactics to stop a fire if it's spreading towards a town, steer it up into the hinterlands where it needs to burn. What we lack is the will amongst many agency decision makers to employ those progressive policies. Within the wildland fire science management community, we're in the midst of a paradigm shift. And the future we see is managing all fires from whatever source, whatever location, as prescribed fires. Because we've done our homework over the winter. We've pre-planned for them. And we have these amazing tools to actually monitor and model and map fires in real time. What are they doing? Where they're going to go? What they're going to do? You don't need any of that if you're just going to stomp on them quick, put them out small. But with these tools, we can actually manage fires in wildlands and for their ecological benefits, their social benefits as well, and better prepare and protect communities. And it's just, we have the policy, it's here, it's just this bureaucratic inertia, and let's face it, the cultural inertia as well. The news media just hypes the dangers, wildfire risks, as if it's all negative, and we don't think about the benefits. But we can manage wildfires with the policies we have. We just need to implement them.
I think my question fits in with that. I'm Virginia Bopp, a member since this year. And I'm asking this on behalf of someone at my table. Chief Wallace, has your department participated in Lane County's efforts to update the Wildfire Community Protection Plan? And can you talk about that?
So, yes, we are trying to help with that. The Oregon Department of Forestry in the last, I'd say about a year, has really kind of taken the lead on that and is doing a lot of that organization and team building. All the fire districts are involved in that. We all kind of lend our 2 cents and our opinions into that. And that's a multifaceted plan. It covers everything from wildfire preparedness to prevention, talks about access, how we get to places, all the way down into building codes, talking about driveways and how they're built and slopes and things like that. So we are working on that. We do take part in working on that as well. As a district, we've also just formed an emergency preparedness group. I always talk to everybody when I try to talk about stuff. I don't talk about wildfire prevention because wildfires are going to happen. I always talk about emergency preparedness and being prepared for when it does happen. So we can do more by being prepared for what's going to happen than trying to stop what's inevitably going to happen anyways. So we have that emergency preparation group, and their main focus is to prepare our valley for an emergency. So they're having meetings and annual trainings on things from chainsaw use to community fuels reduction to getting volunteers that get together and go help a neighbor that maybe can't clean up those bushes or rake those leaves. So,
just a quick note, there is a new policy. It's called the Cohesive Wildland Fire Management Strategy, and it's really revolutionary in that, you know, it understands fire doesn't respect property boundaries. And so it really employs all lands, public and private, state, federal, whatever, all hands, all options. And we've got to get to the point where fire, the responsibility for managing fire isn't just on the shoulders of a few professionals or a few willing volunteers. Whole communities are involved in whatever they can do, preparing for fire, working with fire. The model of here comes a fire, so everyone run away and leave it to Steve and his crew to fend, you know, a single wildfire could threaten 100 homes simultaneously. You can't have an engine in every driveway. Somehow we got to break out the monopoly of fire management, either in government agencies or whatever, and communities and agencies got to collaborate, got to cooperate together. That's the future.
Okay. Kathleen Shorak-Petty, City Club member. You've partially answered this question, but what I'm concerned about is the publicity. So you've told us all these great things we can do to our homes to, you know, avoid fire, but the general public, I don't think they're aware of this. I mean, I feel like we need some kind of a massive information campaign or publicity. What is being done for that, or what can we do so that this can be out there for everyone?
I completely agree with you. I think it was said before that the media really focuses on the negatives and all the bad things that happen with wildfires and not necessarily the positives or the things that we need to do to prepare. A lot of us learned that this year with Snowpocalypse, how unprepared most of us are for an emergency. And that was a pretty small-scale emergency when you think about it. And so it was a disaster. And for us, you know, that's kind of why we've started our group, is because that information's not getting out there. So for our district, we want to make sure that information's getting out there. I know Eugene Springfield Fire is also doing a community reduction program. A lot of it's focused in the South Hills, but that's getting underway. They got a grant to do that. So there's options out there. I just think it's up to people to want to go get that information, and it is also partially our responsibility to get that information out there. That's why our organization has started this group, to make sure our community is getting this information.
That's a great question. There is lots of information and lots of people willing and wanting to provide that information. I think it's something broader. It's like a cultural change is really needed in understanding our relationship with fire. It goes back to our, you know, time immemorial, and maybe a certain amount of peer pressure as well, you know, because you can do all you must to protect your home, but if your neighbor doesn't do their part, then your neighbor's home and property threatens you. So it's got to be again a community responsibility, not just a private property initiative or right. So, but you know, we need cultural change, and not just how we relate to wildland fire, but how we relate to nature itself, wildness itself. It has its place, it has a role, and you know, to me, ending this whole militaristic mentality, and the very word itself, fighting fire, that's Smokey the Bear. What about Flamey the Bear?
Right. Okay. Thank you. Let's give it up one round here. And before we give one more acknowledgement to today's speakers, there are a couple announcements just to get the word out, because one of the things that City Club wants to do is to get the word out to our community. So that is one way City Club seeks to do that. And so we would like to thank public radio station KLCC 89.7 for airing City Club programs on Monday nights at 6:30 p.m. And thank you to Community Television Lane County, Cable Channel 29 for televising recent City Club events. And I also just want to just acknowledge the cross-sectional work that you all are doing today, because it is really going to bring people together. And I just noted how really it is about our property rights, and property owners really going to have to take responsibility as too, as leaders in our community. They're already paying those taxes, and so we ask a lot of them. But next week, we're going to look at sex trafficking and commercial sexual exploitation. Tamara Leroy from Lane County Commercial Sexual Exploitation of Children Multidisciplinary Team and Detective Curtis Newell of the Eugene Police Department will help us to understand what is taking place with this issue along the I-5 corridor and in Lane County. So please join us next week for that. More details and information about future programs can be found online at the City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org. Now, let's thank our speakers once again. And that was Timothy Inglesby and Steve Wallace, both great leaders in our community, and we look forward to hearing more of the work you do and seeing and supporting you down in the Mohawk Valley as well. So this concludes today's program. Thank you, and see you next week.